Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Rotterdam in September 2025. Now, can we really convert industrial CO2 emissions into complete nutrition without using any fertile land? As deforestation claims a forest area the size of 18 football pitches every minute to meet food and feed demands, the search for genuinely sustainable protein sources has never been more urgent. In this episode, three experts reveal radically different approaches to solving the alternative protein challenge, from breathing cultivation systems to the nuanced reality of ultra-processed plant-based meat.
So how do we come to natural plant-based solutions and alternative proteins? What can marine ingredients, what kind of role can they play in the nutritional profile and also sustainability? And how can we, because that's also important, consumers should also like it, how can we improve the taste, texture and sensory experience? So I'm really happy we have great speakers today. And the first speaker I would like to invite is Dr. Kali Chatakondu. He is Global Commercial Director of Arborea. And he will be speaking about actually quite an interesting topic, converting carbon dioxide in food without fertile land. So without further ado, I welcome you to the stage.
Thank you very much. I'd like to start actually by asking a question. So could it really be true that every hour a forest area the size of 18 football fields is destroyed? And it might be surprising, but actually that's not true. It's every minute that that happens. And this deforestation, food and feed demand for fertile land, is something that is basically a crisis for the world. And it's not just about fertile land. We have a situation whereby within 5 years, the world will, the demand for fresh water will exceed supply by 40%. By 2050, most of the soil on the planet will have degraded. And according to a recent study, we all carry the equivalent already of 5 plastic caps worth of microplastics in our brains. So something has to be done about that. But what if you could, instead of emitting carbon dioxide, capture it and convert it into food? What if you had a technology that didn't need any fertile land at all, so therefore no deforestation, no loss of biodiversity? A technology that used minimal fresh water, was easily scalable with low capex, no fermentation tanks, no pressurized gases, no cross-contamination risks from open ponds, etc., and you effectively can provide food security to any country in the world. No tariffs either, actually. So if I introduce the world's first breathing cultivation system, okay, this is a technology that works rather like the human lungs. So we have a mechanism in our bodies whereby we breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. This system does it in reverse. This can breathe in carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen as the byproduct. The carbon dioxide can come from any source. It can come from any industry, non-pressurized. It can come from burning agricultural waste, and you're breathing out pure oxygen as a byproduct. And with this mechanism, you can then cultivate microalgae. You can cultivate it such that you can harvest every single day microalgae. You have 365 harvests rather than one. And from the microalgae, you can extract a whole range of food ingredients, proteins, colors, lipids, bioactive vitamins and minerals. You don't need expensive fermentation tanks. You don't have the cross-contamination risks of open ponds. You don't have expensive internal photobioreactors. We've got a facility in Portugal, a one-to-one pilot facility in Portugal, that demonstrates exactly the techno-economic advantages of a method like this. It's modular, it's scalable, and it means that instead of capturing carbon and burying it, often with and getting carbon credits, often with taxpayers' money, and generating $100 a ton for the carbon dioxide, we can capture it and convert it into food instead. Make $5,000 a ton. Effectively, then, barren land can become cultivatable farmland. So farmers can actually start to make large quantities of food on barren land, and this can therefore happen anywhere in the world with this technology. 2 tons of carbon dioxide becomes 1 ton of food. But why microalgae? 3 billion years ago, the atmosphere of the planet was very different. We're trying our best to get back to that atmosphere, I think, at the moment from what we're doing. But 3 billion years ago, the atmosphere was very largely carbon dioxide. Microalgae came along, started eating that carbon dioxide, emitting oxygen, and that's what we breathe today. They were the origin of life. They are packed, therefore, with nutrients. And today we're talking about positive nutrition. It's all present within these microalgae. You notice the composition here, a huge quantity of protein, not just any protein, a full amino acid profile protein with branched chain amino acids and amino acids that are essential to health. You've got bioactive vitamins and minerals, B1, B2, B3, B6, B12, iron, zinc, magnesium, all in a bioactive form that the cells of the body recognize. If you take it in an inorganic form, cells will just flush out those minerals. In this form, the cells recognize it and take it in. You also have valuable fatty acids there. You have valuable carbohydrates there, all within microalgae. This is the composition of spirulina, but this same technology can make any microalgae, any of the 30,000. So any nutrition, any ingredient found in any microalgae can all be made with this same process, all from carbon dioxide. But we had to start somewhere. We're a startup. So we started with spirulina, one microalgae, and from it we have three product streams. We have the spirulina itself, a bioactive nutrient concentrate. We've got natural blue color that can be extracted from it. And we also have a multifunctional water-soluble protein that we can extract from it. So this protein, it's neutral in taste and color, it's water-soluble, it's rich in amino acids, and it's multifunctional, foaming, gelling, emulsifying, all in one. And you can use it in real-world applications. A lot of demand for natural colors, particularly from the US at the moment, where there's a huge amount of initiatives to reduce the number of artificial ingredients, artificial colors, and replace them from natural sources. But normally, sometimes when you want a natural color, you've had to use a large area of fertile, potentially food-producing land to extract a small amount of natural color. How much more sustainable is it when you can get natural color just by taking a greenhouse gas and turning it into a natural color? And then, of course, you have the actual microalgae and the extracts from it itself. Multiple literature out there in science literatures, in medical literature, in food technology literature to show that spirulina, other microalgae, are actual superfoods for human health, for animal health, pet health. It even makes cat and dog hair very shiny, and soil health for helping regenerate soil. All potential be made and just from carbon dioxide. So here are just a few examples of benefits already in the literature, studies that have been made, proper studies, well-conducted studies, all basically saying if only there was an enabling technology to consistently make microalgae with constant nutrition, constant taste profile, and with no cross-contamination risks, all of these benefits can be realized. Benefits from nutrition, even for cosmetic ingredients, for anti-inflammation in the skin, or for agrochemicals, for soil biostimulants. Literature for women's health, for sports health. For women's health, for example, you talk about bioactive iron. For sports health, you're talking about branched chain amino acids. And for weight loss, you're talking about an insulin response. For pet health, you're talking about the immune system. You know what? All of these benefits are well categorized in the literature as possible to be attained from microalgae. And now there's an enabling technology to make any microalgae just from carbon dioxide. So that's just the beginning. Basically, you can, with different microalgae, you can make essential fatty acids. You can use it as a feedstock for other fermentation. You can use it for all kinds of solutions. So we're a multifunctional team. I'm a chemist myself. We're chemists, biochemists, food scientists, from the very largest of companies to small biotech companies, all working together, but together and from different nationalities, but with one vision. You see, by 2050, the world would need additional fertile land the size of Africa. But with this technology, you could make as much protein as that in a land area just the size of Greater New York. So we're Arborea, and we turn carbon dioxide into food.
A great presentation. I think you highlighted really the urgency of why we need innovations. You use actually technology to lower CO2, but also then transform it into nutritious products. So great example. If you have questions, please write them down, because at the end of the three presentations, we'll have room for questions. Well, talking about technology, processing technology, there's also a lot of discussion about ultra-processed foods. So how should we look at that? So we will have speaker Itske Seip talking about a new look at ultra-processed foods. She is head of innovation from the Vegetarian Butcher Collective.
So my 40 work hours per week I spent at designing ultra-processed foods, and I am proud of that. So I want to take you on why I am proud of crafting ultra-processed foods. So from consumer research, and I'm glad that our consumer insight manager is also in the room, we know that one of the key reasons for consumers to choose plant-based meats over animal meat is because of health. Besides animal welfare and sustainability, health is a key driver. In some countries, number one driver, in others, number three, but usually it ends up in the top three. So what are consumers looking for? They're looking for various things. Protein is high on the hot topic these days, and that's definitely what people are looking for, also because they tend to know that animal meats are high in protein. And this is also what most consumers don't know, is that the majority of people in Europe already get more protein than they need. So it's in many cases twice the amount that they need. And that is based on data from average European consumers with omnivorous diets. So you could argue, okay, these people eat meat. And you can argue that vegetarian vegan people have lower protein intake. And that is absolutely the case. However, even those people still get more protein than what is in dietary advices. So I think protein quantity is important. Is it a huge issue? I'm not convinced. Protein quality is also important to look at. So if you look at protein quality, you need to look at the amino acids profile, which are the building blocks of protein, as well as the digestibility. So there's 9 essential amino acids. Those are the amino acids that you need to get in sufficient amounts. Protein digestibility is about how well your body can absorb these amino acids. So if you then go back to the concern, is plant-based meat providing enough protein quality? The answer is yes. Even though the protein quality tends to be a little bit lower, plant-based foods and plant-based meat can have sufficient protein quality, and especially if you look at the soy as an ingredient that is has a very complete amino acid profile. And also, if you start combining various plant-based meats, you can make up for certain amino acids lacking in one ingredient, make up by another ingredient. And then this diverse diet will really take care of protein quality. So different foods can fill each other's gaps, essentially. So to test that theory in a study we published earlier this year together with Wageningen University, we looked at how replacing animal meat with plant-based meat made from various plant sources would impact protein quality of the, in this case, the Dutch diet. And we found that after the swap, protein intake remained sufficient for the majority of the population. And you see in 93 and 86%, that may sound like a real decrease, but in reality, it's not great. It's not big. If you compare it with the number of people in the Netherlands who get sufficient fiber, that sits at the 10% level. So that might be a more interesting topic to be looking at. So in summary, if we look at protein, if you eat plant-based meat in a balanced diet, protein is should not be a concern. So now going to fiber, I think there's some really great news from most plant-based meats, because the real problem in our diets these days is fiber intake. Also mentioned, and I'm super happy that it starts to become a bigger topic these days. A real problem from an omnivorous diet is fiber intake. Many European countries, you see that almost no country gets to the dietary intake recommendations. And there's really a serious gap there. The good news about plant-based meats is that we tend to base them on proteins from soy or pea protein or other pulses. And those ingredients are naturally high in fiber. So since we use them as a base ingredient, very easily our products contain a naturally source of or even high in fiber. I'm a little bit biased here, but I like to make the link. You see the gap in fiber intake versus the fiber in a portion of one of our products is actually exactly the gap to close. So with one portion, you could actually close an intake gap. I know I'm taking a bit of a shortcut here, but just want to make the point. And then also research linking plant-based meat intake to gut health and microbiome is really on the rise. And evidence about a positive connection is really building. So we expect to publish research on this in Q3 of this year, which is very soon. If consumers talk about healthy nutrition, one thing they call out is baddies or things like salt and saturated fat. And salt is an extremely important element to look at, as this shows sort of the opposite figure of fiber intake. Most consumers eat way too much salt and sodium. So this is also where everyone needs to take responsibility to go lower in sodium. And I'm happy, I think last week or the week before, ProVeg came out with a report looking at all the brands, plant-based meat brands, comparing them to the Dutch food pyramid, let's call it the food pyramid, Schijf van Vijf in the Netherlands. And you see that all the plant-based meat suppliers have actually really improved in complying to that food pyramid. So I think everyone is really doing a great job to improve on the baddies, and especially salt. And then, fiber, there's another sort of hidden gem in plant-based meat. It's basically lack of saturated fat if you compare it to animal meat. So animal meat is naturally high in saturated fat, whereas in plant-based meats, we can choose which fat to use. And therefore, most plant-based meats are high in unsaturated fats. So this is another a nice element of plant-based meats. And one of the reasons that I think, you know, UPF, it's not all that bad. If you want to, I believe you need to take a nuanced look at UPF. So I think a lot has already been said about UPF, and I'm probably preaching to the converted here, not sure. But it is also high on consumers' minds. People think UPF is all bad, and for many UPFs, they are correct, but it's not a black and white situation. With that, I want to argue plant-based meats are a good source of nutrition, especially if you compare to animal meat equivalents. The products tend to be higher in fiber, lower in saturated fat, usually lower in calories. Protein is totally fine in a world with enough protein intake. And of course, first and foremost, they're very tasty, and that's what we work on a daily basis. So, take home message: this is really a UPF. I think I've mentioned most of these items. The key item I want to focus on, I think, the message is most junk food is ultra processed, but not all ultra processed is junk food. And I think our products belong in that category. Thank you very much.
So I think you gave a different perspective, also highlighting the importance of what is the role of like plant-based meat more in a diet context, but also not just looking at processing, and the term might be a bit difficult, but also especially looking at the nutritional profile and how it contributes. So really thank you for the perspective. So we heard plant-based meat mimics, we heard about microalgae, and there are a lot of other sustainable proteins. But how can we turn this potential into reality for the food industry? And this is something that will be discussed by Geraldine Stephanie Ortega. She's R&D manager, dairy and dairy alternatives at Migros Industries. I would really like to welcome you to the stage to tell us more about that topic.
Thank you. So good afternoon, everyone. So first, I would like to introduce a little bit what is the Migros industry and Migros Group. So we are based in Switzerland. And if you have some Swiss cliché in your mind, I think we answer probably some of them. If you think about multilingual country, we are a multilingual company with colleagues speaking German or French as you can guess from my accent, I'm coming from the French part of Switzerland. If you think about chocolate, yes, this is us as well. Some of my colleagues are chocolate producers. And if you think about banking, that works as well, because the Migros groups as such include also a bank. So that's a little bit for a short introduction. And we as Migros industry belongs to Migros Group, and we are so-called integrated producer, which means we are factories and industry producing private label products for the Migros retailer. So Migros is the first largest retailer in Switzerland. As far as I am concerned, I'm working for Elsa Group, and Elsa Group is the dairy and dairy alternatives industrial group of the Migros. In terms of product, that means we have products for the business unit dairy, business unit plant-based, cheese and sauces. And for the business unit plant-based, there we are talking very concretely about soy or coconut drinks, as well as fermented vegels, as we like to name them, which has fermented plant-based products, and as well tofus. So these are very precisely the type of products that we are dealing with. When it comes to unlocking the potential of alternative proteins, I wanted to share with you our experience about the value chain. So because when you are in the industry, the difficulty to maintain these sustainability cues start really from the first point of the value chain, which is obviously agriculture and farming. So this is very much of a challenge to understand about sustainable proteins. The agriculture sector, it's very important. You need to think local versus importing those proteins from where they are coming from. You need also to understand the integration of these different farming actors. We got very nice experience with soybeans when we had to deep dive a bit more concretely into the research, so agronomical research for Switzerland, who are producing those soybeans, what type of varieties are available, and what are the specificities of those varieties regarding the product quality that you need to have afterwards. It was very important at this stage to really put people all together, including also the seed collection centers and also distributor centers to the farmers, because sometimes the expectation or the the requirements for the industry and the farmers are not the same. They are looking for yields, and you are looking for protein content, and sometimes both farming yields and protein contents are not connected or going in the opposite direction when it comes to the soybean variety you want to crop. And you better understand that early on in your process of developing products if you want to be successful, if you want to ensure that you introduce or you integrate also climate change effect and impact for the farmers early on. So as a Swiss industry, it's really important for us to understand that. And it was really important for this specific case of soybean selection to build a good partnership very much early on with these different actors to be sure that we are selecting sustainable protein sources for soybeans. Then next step is all about storage and supply. So this is at the heart of retail and the supply chain, as you may understand. So when it comes to storage and supply for these different sustainable proteins, it's also another type of challenge there. It's pretty much about understanding maybe for some actors like startups, what are the needs for an industry like us when it comes to storage and supply chain? We need to manage the production planning and the production frequency according to maybe a shelf life of the raw materials that is proposed to us. This is not always compatible. Startups, they need to scale up, they start with very small quantity. So sometimes when they come to an industrial partner like us, they are not mature enough or ready yet to propose to us really what we need in terms of supply volumes, for instance. We're talking about minimum order quantity sometimes to be able to make a simple batch of production. And this is creating sometimes some tensions. And this is just stopping this nice new ingredient to be delivered to our consumers. So here again, the message is really to think beyond, I would say, simple raw material specifications. Sometimes you can come with a very attractive ingredient. You've checked in the research all the box for sustainability, but the supply or the storage conditions stop it to be industrialized. And that's a pity for the consumers. Next, I think this is maybe what we... I am a food technologist as a background, so that's maybe the most known area. It's all about the transformation of the sustainable proteins. I will not teach you anything new if I'm telling you that what matters on that manufacturing step is to be sure that the product quality, we call product performance also, I heard it today, as well as the regulatory requirements are well managed. And this is the pure R&D work. The R&D teams are most of the time here to enable that. We need to adapt the solution to the manufacturing processes that we are using. And what is important for an industry like us is, of course, the efficiency. We want to reduce as much as we can food waste through this step. And we need to ensure the right cost target, because at the end, it has also to reach the consumer at the right cost target. Food waste, I will also insist a little bit on that because I don't want to spoil the end of my presentation, but it's becoming more and more important for our consumers, and maybe the sustainability levers are a bit shifting from the pure ingredient towards the overall value chain, and the consumer, they want to know more and more about what the industry is doing with food waste. And for us, food waste at the moment of transforming the raw materials is quite important, and we are trying to reduce it as much as possible. So really, what matters in the manufacturing efficiency step is to design sustainable food solutions that goes beyond the pure ingredients we are using, but which is also including the full line production efficiency, which means reducing food waste. You can think about energy as well, but also making sure that we are doing it with the right cost. Then it comes to the distribution. So then we need to reach our retail and our shops with the logistic solution. And it would be a pity if we lose all the advantages of having worked on sustainable solution upfront, to lose all these sustainability benefits while we are transporting this final product to our consumers. So on the logistic part, what we really care about in order to leverage the sustainability of our product is first packaging solution. There's a lot of work currently about also ensuring that we are using the least packaging material as possible to pack our product. And this is also about sustainability, not the protein itself, but the full package, the full solution. And also, for instance, recycled packaging materials. We care also about the way these products are transported to our shops. And we do not, for the Migros case, it's very specific in Switzerland. We have a system of transport crates, which are reusable, so that you clean and you reuse back to fill it again and transport it to the retail shop. And of course, also, we are having programs to ensure that our supply chain systems with the trucks and so on are low in carbon emissions, and also using some electric hybrid trucks or whatever you want to think about. So really, there the message is to say, if we want to leverage sustainability as in our product, it does not stop at the recipe or at the formulation, even not at the manufacturing process, but it has also to be credible to our consumer. And our consumer, they are more and more educated about what the industry is doing. And transportation is, of course, a key element. And that's all about it at the end of the day. It's all about our consumers. It's all about you. So basically, we need to understand better what consumers expect when we are telling them we are sustainable. If we look at the latest study made in Germany from a Mintel report about sustainability in food and drink, it's very interesting to see how consumers are now changing their view on sustainability for food. It's less and less about what is inside the product, but also more about the pricing and more about the overall the food waste. So basically, it's becoming food waste is becoming more important, and ingredients seems to be less important. Why? Because they are also very much touched by the raw material price rises. So now it's also telling them that they need to make sure that they have also affordable products, and sustainability is not enough for them to trade off on that. So this is also very important to understand how the market in terms of sustainability is moving. So obviously, the shift in these consumer sustainability drivers can really make the difference. to be successful in the marketplace. So in short, these are basically a bit of a summary. When it comes to unlocking the potential of sustainable proteins, I think it really demands a really good integrative view from start to the end, from the end-to-end value chain, because challenges about sustainability can express itself at each step. If the supply chain model is not considered at the early stage, it can just kill your innovation. Whatever research, whatever investment you've made into your new raw materials, it's just not possible to industrialize it, and it's also not possible to sell it at the right cost. So that's also would be a pity. And finally, to continue understand, because the world is changing very fast, what sustainability means for the consumers. Is it more what is inside, or is it more about food waste? This is two completely different approach to the topic, and I think it's very important to see this evolution and try to answer it as much as best as we can all together. Voilà, that's it.
Yeah, thank you, Geraldine. Really nice to see if you think about the sustainability of proteins, but also will they be a success in the end? It's good to look at the whole supply chain. So thanks for also adding that perspective to the speakers we already had. So we have time for two questions. Are there any questions from the audience? No? Then I had one question for Dr. Kali. Actually, in the last presentation, we heard about the whole supply chain. And I think in your presentation, you focused, of course, on more the agriculture part. So how do you use CO2 to transform it into food? But then you go into products. So how does the, if you look at sustainability, how is the next part of your process, if you have the microalgae to the product, how do you look at that compared to also your starting process?
So there's two aspects to look at that. Firstly, the byproduct from removing the protein from the microalgae is actually a biostimulant that can make fertile land more fertile. So you can help actually creating a circular argument for that. And secondly, the process to actually converting the microalgae into protein, colors and other things is a very gentle process, a very natural process that doesn't require much energy. So the entire process is actually either carbon neutral or carbon negative. So and you have the byproducts that actually would help the soil in the first place. So I think it's important to look at the entire process, as I say, and it's also important that every part of the supply chain can potentially benefit from that process commercially. So if a farmer can use non-fertile land, if you can have a feedstock that is free and plentiful, and if actually the processors can use something that it can work in an industrial process, and then it's got to taste great. So at the end of the day, that's the thing that pulls it all the way through. It's got to be good for you and it's got to taste great.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks a lot. Any questions now from the audience? No? Oh, yeah. There's a question in the back. Thank you.
I have a question for Itske. You mentioned that the plant-based proteins are much better when it comes to comparing to the rest of the protein because of fiber and many things that you said, what you said. If you were to compare multiple sources of this plant-based proteins, let's say pea protein or red lentil proteins or soya protein, how do you compare that and what sort of nutrition value do you get as an advantage when you choose pea protein over lentil protein over soya protein or whatever?
I have to give you the answer another time because I don't have the numbers really in my head. We have looked at, we are constantly looking for multiple, at multiple protein sources. And we take our decision what protein source to use. We based on multiple elements. One is nutritional elements. But another important one is functionality. So the texture we're looking for, some proteins give different textures than other proteins. So very, I think, nice one. And how do you say that? A nice
clear one is, for example, rice protein gives you that fish texture very easily, whereas soy protein would be difficult to make it. So we also choose our protein source for that. Cost, of course, is an important driver. So sustainability is a driver. So there's really a multifaceted approach. That doesn't answer your question. but I don't know the actual nutrition numbers by heart right now. I do know soy protein from a amino acid composition is the one of the better ones, if not the best ones, if you only take that one. But I think my argument would be combining plant proteins is always best.
Yes. Thank you very much. So one more applause for the speakers.